Getting started. What is a dysfunctional marriage? What is it? What does a dysfunctional marriage look like? I think it's important that we take a few minutes up front to seek to clarify our terminology. What is a dysfunctional marriage? Think of a couple whose marriage is not functioning well. You should be able to come up with at least one couple, at least those who are ministers, church leaders. What are the characteristics of that relationship which you would say define it as dysfunctional? Think a moment. Would someone want to give a brief example? Maybe in sharing, you might reveal something you don't want to reveal. I'll not put anyone on the spot. I think of a situation, something I observed while our family was at Freedom Hills in Ohio for 3.5 years, serving there, a counseling ministry, a church-related counseling ministry. I observed out through a window a man driving his vehicle, and these were clients there for a period of counseling. A man driving his vehicle down the driveway, and his wife was outside the vehicle, and she would come up to the door on the passenger side and reach for the door handle, and at that point, the husband would move the car forward. He would go up a bit and stop, and the wife would go up to the door and try to get in, and he would move ahead. That, to me, is an example of an extremely angry husband venting his fury on his wife. A dysfunctional marriage, or an example of a dysfunctional marriage, if I've ever seen one. He would not allow his wife to get into the car. Go ahead and stop. Go ahead, stop. Not allowing her to enter the vehicle. Clearly a dysfunctional marriage. Now, what is a functional marriage? One that is functioning. What does it look like? And I'd encourage you to think of a couple. Bring that couple to your mind. Maybe someone from years back, but a marriage you would hold up and say, that's the kind of marriage I'd like to have. That's functional. Here's a healthy, alive, vibrant marriage relationship. Now, I'd encourage you to come up with your own picture, your own example. I think of my mother and father. Not that they were perfect in their marriage. They weren't. My father died in September 2007. At the time of his death, over a period of, I don't know how long the period of time was, but it was an extended period. But at the time of his death, My mother and father had played 336 games of Scrabble. They enjoyed playing Scrabble together. And Dad had won 168 games. And guess what? Mom had won 168 games also. Not a perfect relationship, but something is clearly right about this scene, this relationship. We're talking about dysfunctional marriages, but let's not lose sight of functional marriages in all of this. Actually, I'd like for us, let's leave it at that. Let's not lose sight of functional marriages. Now, a number of quick case studies, and I won't mention names or in any way seek to identify anyone, and I'm not violating confidentiality here. These will be brief case studies, and don't try to figure out who these people are either. Here's a marriage. Now, these are actual cases. All of these I have some level of exposure to. Here's a couple that has been married for almost 40 years. And even before this couple was married, and this is a Mennonite couple, by the way, even before the couple was married, the man had a problem with pornography. He's continued to have a problem over the years. And as far as I know, the problem is not resolved. His wife has put on an act. And for the sake of her husband and her children and her family, whom she values highly, she has told only two, possibly three people in all of that time. They go to church. A good family, a decent marriage at least, by all appearances. But year after year, there has been this hidden thread, this secret in their relationship, in their marriage. How do you respond to a situation like that if you were to become aware of that? Here's another situation. A man I don't know how to describe this as a Mennonite family. I don't know how to describe this man except to say he's mean. He's just a mean man. And he's been mean for a long, long time. And he's wore down his wife. And there are a number of children, grown children involved, who take the side of their mother. And maybe one could say, yes, they should. They separate. And it's almost a situation I want to be careful how much I say here. But in bringing up this little case study, it highlights the need that there can be at times to work especially with the husband or with the father in a situation like this and to find a way of encouraging him, helping him, prodding him to grow up. His lack of growing up has poisoned his marriage relationship and his relationship with his children, and he's alienated from every one of his children. They don't want to have anything to do with him. Here's another example. An older couple, they get remarried. Both have lost their partners. And so they get married later on in life. A second marriage for both of them. She wants help, but she admits that she feels no love for her husband, her second husband. She says, "I don't love him," but she wants help. And her husband needs help too, but he's resistant to getting help. How do you respond to a situation such as that? Here's another example. And yes, here's a passive husband and a controlling wife. And this is an actual situation. This happens to be an Amish couple. And I'm not singling out the Amish. I mentioned Mennonites earlier. The husband is passive, has been passive for quite some time, and there's a pattern of passivity. There's a controlling wife who gives the appearance of being relatively normal. And if you talk to the wife, you get the idea that she has her husband figured out. And she can tell you what's going on, what's wrong with her husband, and she can do it in such a way that you come away thinking, you know, that husband does need to shape up here. He's got a problem. But if you start digging a little more deeply, begin to recognize or to ask yourself, where is the problem in this relationship? Two more situations here at this point. Here's a couple in which the man struggles with depression and some other things as well. But he can become irritable and low, moody, and it affects his relationship with his wife and with his family, his children. And the man responded well to medication and takes a low dosage of medication to help even out the ups and downs. And it makes a real difference in his ability to cope with the day-to-day responsibilities of life, and it helps his marriage and his relationship with his children. How would you handle this next case and the last one that I'll mention at this point? Here's a couple, a Mennonite couple, in which the husband has a more conservative outlook on life, on church affairs, than what his wife does. And it affects their relationship, and it affects the way in which they relate to their children. And it creates some confusion among the children. How do you help a marriage relationship such as that? Last evening, Claire Martin shared, and I'm going to take some of that as background for what we're dealing with here. We have till 4. And move quickly through this next section. I would like to get to that third part before our time is up. What is marriage? It may seem like a silly question. We all know what marriage is, don't we? To a certain extent, we do. I'd like to offer you a definition here. Again, I'll condense some of the material that I have. Consider this definition. I'm not saying it's the world's best definition of marriage, but for myself, I found it helpful. Marriage is a mutual. It means there's more than one person involved. Exclusive, lifelong, one flesh, and that needs to be unpacked all by itself, one flesh union between a husband and wife, characterized by troth. What is troth? T-R-O-T-H. This is J.H. Olthuis who is giving this definition. Troth, he says, is an old English word for fidelity, faithfulness, truth, trust, love, and commitment. That package there defines troth. Fidelity, truth, trust, love, and commitment. And he goes on, one more sentence. Marriage is the ultimate human connection in which two people commit themselves fully and trothfully to each other in a lifelong journey of deep sharing, mutual respect, and growing intimacy. Marriage is the ultimate human connection. That phrase caught my attention in this definition. The ultimate human connection. But what goes wrong in this ultimate human connection? Why do so many marriages struggle? And in a group this size, even in a group of ministers, there are some marriages that are functioning better here than others. The ultimate human connection. I do want to keep moving, and I do hope that there is some time for response, interaction, as we continue. What are the purposes of marriage? If we had the time, it would be helpful to have a board here and write down things that come from the group. What are the purposes of marriage? What's it for? I'd mention at least 6 things here. Companionship. And think of this story of the first man and the first woman that was reviewed for us last evening. Companionship. The woman who was brought to the man, and we know the man's response. Man couldn't find companionship in that which had been created prior to the woman. Enjoyment. You don't think Adam enjoyed what was taking place there? Yeah. You know, marriage really is meant to be enjoyable. We can lose sight of that. times it can seem awfully lot, an awful lot like a duty. Man, I've got to do this. You know, I've got to keep going. And there's a place for a sense of duty. I've got to do what is right. But it's meant to be filled with joy. Remember, it's that ultimate human connection spoken of earlier. Completeness. Two people complementing, filling each other out. Becoming something together that they could not become separately. That's powerful. Fruitfulness. It's a place in which the love between a man and a woman can bring new life into being, and that new life can be nurtured in a secure environment. Fruitfulness. To use maybe a more technical word, or a word that we don't use that often, procreation, fruitfulness. There's an aspect of protection in the marriage relationship. And I need to be careful that I don't elaborate and keep moving here. It's a type of Christ in the church. That's the last one that I would mention. Companionship, enjoyment, completeness, fruitfulness, protection, and marriage as a human object lesson of the relationship between Christ and the church, between Christ and His people. Ephesians 5. We're familiar with that passage. And you can use this list as a way of evaluating the health of a marriage. Ask, to what extent are these two people, and you have these two people in mind in this relationship, to what extent are these two people truly companions on the journey of life? Do they look like they're enjoying themselves? Do they complete each other, enriching and enabling the other to blossom? And I think of that one situation that I mentioned earlier in which the man was mean. I don't know how else to describe the man except he was just a mean man. And those questions, those three questions I asked based on the first three purposes of marriage, every one of those I would answer no in that situation. It's clear something has gone wrong. It's not right. What is love? Of course, we all know what love is, don't we? But if pressed, how would you define love? More specifically, Christian married love. I came across this years ago, a definition by Richard Dobbins. Christian married love is a persistent effort on the part of two people to create for each other the circumstances in which each can become the person God intended him or her to be, a better person than he or she could become alone. And one cannot improve on Paul's definition of the love that a husband is to demonstrate in Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church. And as you begin to unpack how Christ loved the church, you get a clearer picture of what love in a marriage relationship is to be, especially in this case pertaining to the husband. If a husband, I've concluded, if a husband loves his wife in that way, I don't want to say every time, always, but close, his wife will follow him anywhere. His wife will respond. Again, I want to acknowledge that there can be exceptions. I'm not saying 100%. But how many dysfunctional marriages could be made more functional? I'm not saying perfect, but more functional if the husband would do everything within his power to love his wife the way Christ loved the church. A footnote here. How can we help our people, not just married couples, to move ahead in their capacity to give and receive love? It's been said that love is an art to be learned and a discipline to be maintained. That's Ed Wheat and Gloria Oaks Perkins in their book, Love Life for Every Married Couple, which I would recommend. Love doesn't just fall from the sky on top of your head and all at once you have it. Love is something that is learned. We learn to love. And I've seen too many people, more men than women, I would surmise, although I can't prove it, who would seem to have been stunted along life's way in this love learning process. You know, we would think that a person, they're an adult, they should know how to love, how to give, how to receive love. Not necessarily. Some are further along, much further along than others. Now, moving into this third section, what are the options, the basic options, when confronted with a dysfunctional marriage? A marriage where something clearly is not as it should be. Now, I worked up this list, and there are five basic options. And if you're seeing any other options, I'd be glad to be told that. And I'll alter my list. But these are the basic options that I've come up with when, as leaders, we're confronted with a dysfunctional marriage. The first option that I would mention here, we can choose to deny, dismiss, ignore the problem. It doesn't exist. There's not a problem here. G. Edwin Bontrager, in his book, Divorce and the Faithful Church, and I would differ from where he comes out on some things, but in his book he makes the comment, "The church which finds it so difficult to recognize and accept a legal divorce has many times passively sat by while an internal divorce was in existence for many years." I see heads nodding. we deny that there's a problem. Now, on the other extreme, denial over here, at the other end of the spectrum, we could take the problem so seriously, so personally, that we stake our reputation as leaders, as pastors. We stake our reputation as persons on its successful resolution. And if we don't fix this problem, then I'm a failure. Do you see the two extremes there? On the one hand, complete denial. On the other hand, choosing to become so immersed that if there's not a successful outcome, it brings us down. It's a personal threat, a personal affront. It's a dysfunctional response, as I see it, to a dysfunctional marriage, that kind of response. Now, in between, there are some other responses, in between those two extremes. We can vacillate, go back and forth in relation to the problem, and enter into a period of unproductive hand-wringing. Oh, what do I do? There's a problem here. Oh, I'm not sure what to do, though. We're not denying the problem, but we're not marking out a course and choosing to move ahead. And we're stuck there. Now, there's another option. We can seek to refer the party, the couple, to another person or to another party, maybe a counselor that we know in another area, whatever it might be. We can seek to refer the problem on to someone else. And that can be a wise move in certain situations, to refer the problem on. This is more than what I can handle, at least at this time. I refer. And then there's a fifth approach, or option. Approach the problem, the dysfunctional marriage, with a purpose. Choosing to listen, support, pray, assess, develop a plan, mobilize resources, implement the plan, motivate those who are involved, including the couple, evaluate what's going on, adjust if there are adjustments that need to be made in the plan, and if necessary, refer. So we can either deny, we can take it personally, we can vacillate, that hand-wringing, we can refer, we can approach the problem with purpose. I have there appropriate goals in marriage counseling. I'm going to pass over that. I would mention this, though. Consider this statement. It's from Eugene Kennedy and Sarah Charles. It is important to realize that in most emotional problems, and if you expand that a bit to include emotional, spiritual, marriage problems, it is important to realize that in most emotional problems, a little help is a lot of help. We get this notion that we have to take this couple all the way to the finish line and where they will win the award for world's best couple. I would say lower your expectations. Recognize that a little help is often a lot more help than what we might initially realize. Well, I'll know better how to make adjustments the second time around. Some practical starting points for a minister, a leader, wanting to help. I'll try to go through these rapidly and to refrain from too much elaboration. Give thanks for marriages that work, even if they don't seem to be the best marriages in the world. That is, in my opinion or your opinion. Be aware of the wide variations in patterns of functional marriages. They don't all have to be cookie-cutter marriages. We need to be careful that we don't push a couple to an ideal that's selected by me. They have to fit into this particular mold in order for it to be functional. Give thanks for marriages that work, even if they may not be the best marriages in the world. Another thing, cultivate the approach. How might I help this marriage be better? As opposed to, how can I make this marriage perfect? Another thing, be aware of who you listen to first. When you wade into a situation, it's been said, source unknown, there are three sides to every story. Your side, the other person's side, and the truth. More than once, I've heard one of the partners weigh in, and I start inwardly assenting. They've got a point here. I can see why they're... Yeah. And I start taking sides. And then I hear the other person begin to talk, and the picture becomes more clear. Another thing, listen to what a person tells you, but also listen for what he or she is not telling you. Focus on the person, the couple, rather than on a specific method, program, or formula. And I'm not against some of the things that are out there that can be used in terms of approaches, methods, workbooks, and so forth. But your focus should be on the people, not on forcing them through a program that you think is just great and it's going to be the solution for these people. Beware of what Gerard Egan, and this is another point, calls the law of the instrument. You know, if you give a youngster a hammer, that youngster can soon discover that nearly everything needs hammering. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, tap, tap. The child begins to hammer everywhere. The law of the instrument. And he applies this especially to the tendency of helpers, people helpers, to see all human problems as needing their attention. But I expand that, and I think it can be applied as well to a range of methods, approaches, programs, models, skills, schemes, and techniques that we can latch onto. And boy, this is great. Next person we meet, tap, tap, tap. Next problem situation, tap, tap, tap. We're using that hammer. Beware of the law of the instrument. And that's not to say there can't be good methods, programs, and so forth. I think you're hearing me on that. Be honest. This would be another thing. Be honest with yourself about your ability and your availability. Two things that are important to keep in mind. Are you able to deal with this? And if you are able, do you have the energy, the time, to take it on? And if not, then you need to look at some form of referral. I'm going to move ahead here a bit. Determine whether to work with the husband and wife together or individually. You know, to what extent, you may want to ask yourself, is the problem here in this marriage a marriage problem? And to what extent might it be a personal problem on the part of one or both of the partners, husband or wife? There might be the case in which focus is needed first on a particular problem that the husband has or the wife has, as opposed to just working with them as a couple right from the beginning. Make it your policy as a minister, a helper, to never meet alone with a woman or a minor. Have someone else present in that situation. Just make it a rule of thumb, and you can instantly tell a person, we need to have someone else present. You won't go there. Avoid marathon counseling sessions or times when you are together. Like if you get together with a couple, there can be exceptions. But work for an hour and conclude and set up another appointment. It's been my experience that a session that goes on for hours and hours can tend to become unproductive. Don't overlook some of the basic tools that it should always be in your toolbox as a pastoral helper, counselor. Listening, confession, prayer, patience, boldness, love, the work of the Holy Spirit. Keep these tools in your toolbox. They're powerful. And we may want to think, well, I don't have particular training. You know, I haven't gone to school. I don't have a degree. Don't minimize the tools that you do have in your own toolbox to help. And then keep that toolbox in order and keep your tools sharp and ready to go. Don't fear periods of silence during times of counseling. Too often, a counselor's own discomfort will lead him to take a person off the hook. I remember a time something came up. I'm not sure if I asked a question or a statement was made, but a husband and wife were there, and it was directed to the husband. And it may have been 5 minutes, it may have been 10 minutes. I don't know that I was counting. Nothing was said. But we all knew the burden was upon the man, and it was for him to respond. And if I spoke, I would get him off the hook. And I waited him out, and it proved to be a positive thing in that situation. Be alert to ways in which a couple or an individual ring your bells, set you off, trigger you. Some people might do that, and you've got to be aware of that. Recognize that not everyone is eager to change. Even if a person says he wants to or she wants to, even if there's pain, you can't automatically assume this person is wanting to change. It's 4 o'clock. develop and operate out of a realistic assessment of human nature and behavior. Lauren Sanford made this statement: "Those of us with pastors' hearts have a very difficult time facing the fact that people are basically nasty." Chew on that one for a while. I can accept it, I think, as long as he's not excluding pastors from his statement. We can be nasty as well. Think through your understanding of people, who they are, their behavior. Take premarital counseling seriously. I'm all for premarital counseling, but I'm not quite sure how effective it is, how effective it always is. Can you think of situations in which an individual couple should have been advised to not get married? Maybe you can think of situations like that. There may be times when we need to say, "No, I don't think you're ready. Don't move ahead with this. They have stars in their eyes." Final thing, and I'll have to conclude here. And again, next session I'll know better how to gauge. Choose in Christ to love those you seek to help. Peter Riedemann, an early Hutterite, said, "Only love does God's work." If we don't love the people we're seeking to help, in the long run, we're not going to be helpful. Only love does God's work. It's after 4. We didn't get to a time for interaction. I was hoping for that. I appreciate your attention. We'll simply need to conclude at this point. Thank you very much.